Well, we go from that lovely, uplifting tune to the border of America with Mexico. A 48-page report from the Inspector General just came out a week ago, reporting some 9,000 children's psychological condition. Closer in description of the report, that they are, in a sense, suffering almost battlefield-like reactions to the separation from family and friends, their trauma. In fact, the trauma has been so severe for the social workers and workers with these children that they are themselves reporting severe trauma and fears for their own mental health. A little boy is quoted in the report as saying, "I can't feel my heart." Well, that's why we're here every week, to feel our hearts, to move past what Jesse Jackson calls the paralysis of analysis, just to feel. So yes, this is an annual lecture, but it happens in a time where the American vision of the other has re-arisen, and it's not pretty. It's not good. And so this sermon isn't some peon to the past. It is real and present, and it is inspired with the very clear notion that the truth shall set you free. So it provides perspective, yes, and context, yes. But most of all, it's as much of the truth that I can feel in 25 minutes. Margaret Atwood's new book, a sequel to her bestseller, is called The Testaments of The Handmaid's Tale. And in the new novel, she talks about why she set The Handmaid's Tale in Massachusetts, because she was inspired by reading, yes, Puritan divines. She says in the new book, "The same wailings from the new arrivals, the same barking and shouts from the guards. How tedious is tyranny in the throes of enactment. It's always the same plot." You know, you don't have to buy completely into de Tocqueville's observation in the 1830s that New England formed America, and that Boston, the Mass Bay, is hugely influential in determining who we are as a people. He said, "This is not one opinion, one habit, one law that does not look back to that Puritan past." Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. And how the Mass Bay Puritans dealt with and partially created the other is just crucial today to our present situation. It just is. And first of all, when the Puritans came here, they were dealing with their own self-identification, if as not the other, capital O, then as those who will be apart from all those that they wish to be apart from. Now, the Pilgrims, it is true, came as separatists, and the folks that founded Boston came as non-separatists, but they still wanted to be away. They wanted to create a holy people, a new Israel, beyond their Anglican roots. And so the first other that they had to deal with were the troublemakers within. These weren't just the people that were interested in commercialism or secularism, if you will. They had to deal with those that didn't buy into the mission. We've had a little touch of Ann Bradstreet and a mention and invocation of Ann Hutchinson. And Hutchinson actually had evening meetings where the governor, Henry Vane, came, and she basically was a gigantic thorn in the side of the male ministers. And the problem was that she was more intelligent than they were, and therefore she had to be exiled. She had to go. But for me, the most poignant part of the Puritan enterprise is what happened by 1662. It's not terribly far into the Puritan experiment in America, is that they realized that the other were their children and grandchildren, because they couldn't live up to their strictures and the ability to portray to one another and to the leaders of any individual congregation their experiential quality of being allowed to be a member of the church. It was an experience that they had to convey and be accepted by others. And their children weren't interested in doing it or couldn't do it. And so they created the halfway covenant, meaning you're going to get grandfathered in, literally grandfathered in, and you can become a church member even though you can't be as pure a Puritan as we are. And then the traction really begins with the next other that they had to deal with. And of course, it was the people all around them that had been living there for centuries upon centuries, the Native Americans. John Eliot, one of our divines, was here for 15 years before he realized that he needed to translate the Bible into their language. And he created what he called praying towns. The first was Natick, but they were all around. And they were designed because he had this idea that these people were their spiritual equals. This was obviously a radical notion that they could enter into full church membership. Thomas Shepard, the minister from Cambridge, disagreed. He said that the natives presented, quote, a vast distance from common civility, almost of humanity itself. But John Eliot persevered. He persevered until the advent of the King Philip War. And the historian Jill Lepore writes that although most Americans have forgotten about the King Philip's War, that in terms of the small population living in America at the time, it was actually one of America's most bloodiest wars per capita. And it wiped away, in so many ways, this early Puritan enterprise to reach out to the Native Americans. And then, the African. This sermon really began for me this summer when I encountered the book Stamped from the Beginning by Ibram X. Kendi. Has anyone read Stamped from the Beginning? It is an astonishing book. It is, I believe, the definitive book on race in America. And he presents five guides through American history as to how we understand how we've gotten where we are. And guess who the first guide is? Cotton Mather, yay! In fact, the whole Mather family, Richard Mather, Increase Mather from this congregation, its lineage, and Cotton Mather. And these preachers, in that preaching lineage of this church, they were the divines. They were the spiritual, towering intellectual figures that not only influenced the Mass Bay, but frankly, all of American history. Cotton Mather, according to Kendi, quote, preached racial inequality in the body while insisting that the dark souls of the enslaved Africans would become white when they became Christians. That was his message. And it was pretty radical and weirdly liberal in the context of the times. Racism doesn't begin or end with the Puritans. We know that. Aristotle wrote that humanity is divided into two, masters and slaves. He said they, the slaves, were, quote, by nature incapable of reasoning and live a life of mere sensation, like certain tribes on the borders of the civilized world. This goes back a long way, and it goes forward a long way into our very hearts and being. St. Augustine, an African, wrote that slaves, in contradiction to Aristotle, they were human beings, a rational, moral creature, no matter. It took long, long centuries to create slavery as we came to know it in the antebellum years before the Civil War. It's the slavery that we think of that is the dark, deep abyss, the nadir, our original sin, at the core of our history. Of people bound for their whole lives, shorn of the fruits of their labor, their wages, family life, education, and that their children were to be born into slavery in perpetuity. That's the slavery we think of. And that's not what the Puritans experienced or held with. They took a biblical understanding of slavery. There was a continuum between being an indentured servant and being a slave. But as we shall see, it was a mighty slippery slope. And we got to be very careful before we start congratulating ourselves. John Winthrop is presiding when Africans first come to New England. And you know why and how? Because they believed in the biblical sense that someone could sell themselves into slavery and be an indentured servant, not for their whole life, and that they were to be educated, and that their children were to be born into freedom, but they were still slaves. And that slaves could also come to them if they were captured in war. And so slavery begins in New England because of the Pequot Indian Wars. And so the ship, the Desire, on February 26, 1638, Winthrop records in his diary, "Mr. Pierce on the Salem ship Desire returned from the West Indies after 7 months. He has been at Providence Island and brought some cotton and tobacco and Negroes." What had happened is that New Englanders were discovering that Pequot Indians made very poor slaves. They just didn't enjoy having them around the house. And they thought maybe if we could simply trade with other English institutions and bring forth Africans. So that's what happened. They took Pequot Indians and moved them down into Nicaragua and brought Africans from Nicaragua. That's at the core of the Puritan enterprise. And so John Winthrop did not have African slaves, but he did have Indian slaves. That's something we're probably going to have to deal with the statue out front. That's something that the Standing Committee and all of us as members of First Church and anyone who wants to celebrate the 400th got to deal with. The truth shall set you free. John Cotton in 1636 and then codified in 1641 said that slavery was legal here. Captives in just wars and, quote, such strangers as willingly sell themselves or are sold to us. Well, it is true. Cotton Mather patiently educated his slaves, saying that, quote, they are one blood with us and have immortal souls, and that they are not mere beasts of burden. But one way or another, for me, the story culminates in 1706, right before Cotton Mather dies. He has just published a pamphlet called The Negro Christianized. And his congregation, Second Church, was so proud of him that they went out and spent £40 to buy him, quote, a very lively slave. Churches, apparently in New England, had a long history of rewarding ministers with captives. And he named him Wanamoso after St. Paul's adopted son, a converted runaway. So, great. You can take all this and essentially say, well, you know, slavery in New England was not as crushing and horrible as it was to come to be. And that is true. But you can also argue, and I think much more fairly, and more importantly, much more spiritually whole and truthful, to say that it provided the intellectual and spiritual impetus to create that slippery slope into the abyss we all fell into that haunts us today. Now, Desmond Tutu said that in the end, we are all creatures of hope. If we are spiritual people, we are creatures of hope. Creatures of hope are not creatures of evasion or of excuses. They look unflinchingly at the truth of who we are. Now, I have heard over and over again in the last year or two the quote, how many times have you heard this? Well, this isn't who we are. How many times have you heard that from pundits? This isn't who we are. Well, this is very much who we are, but it is not who we have to remain, and it is not who we have to somehow be. And this is why this isn't a history lesson. This is about an invocation to the people that we might become together. Together. Winthrop said in Eden, quote, all are of as of the same flesh and image of God. And he believed it and he lived it. But we are not in Eden, and nor are they. And the Hebrew scriptures told them over and over, and they paid a lot of attention to the Hebrew scriptures, that how you treat the stranger was going to be, in the end, how you were to be defined as a believer. That all were to be treated in friendship, fairness, and justice. Deuteronomy 10:19, you shall also love the stranger, and for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And Leviticus 19:34, and you shall love the alien as yourself. Well, those are important words. And there are other words that are important. William Emery Channing, the great Unitarian divine, said, we love our country, but not blindly. In all nations, we recognize one great family. In 1833, the Pequot minister, William Pepys, said, you know, of all the peoples in the world, if you had maybe someone of my people, my tribe, and a typical white person, look and see what crimes are inscribed upon their forehead by God. See if you can see what is written there. The crimes on my people's forehead would hardly register, he said. But the crimes on their forehead. And yet, after this indictment, William Pepys said that there was a prayer that he wanted to pray with all the people of Massachusetts. Quote, that the mantle of prejudice will be torn from every American heart. Then shall peace pervade the nation. Mariah Stewart, on the backside of Beacon Hill, rose up and said, not only as a free black woman, that she demanded her rights to walk the streets of Boston unimpeded, unfettered. She said, I am a true born American. Your blood flows in my veins, and your spirit lies in my breast. The truth of who we are is complex, it is shifting, it is difficult, and it is disturbing. But I would suggest to you that it is also our only true path out of the labyrinth of race, our contest with the other, who never was the other, who was not even the stranger, but another soul and sojourner in this life. I end today with the words of William Du Bois, who I think is one of the greatest Americans who ever lived. Yes, he despaired over America, and yet he could never surrender America to its own instincts. He said, nations reel and stagger on their way. They make hideous mistakes. They commit frightful wrongs. But they do great and beautiful things. And shall we not best guide humanity to telling the truth about all this, so far as the truth is ascertainable? In a toxic and sometimes ugly time, we as spiritual people can do two things at the same time. We can look unflinchingly at our hideous mistakes. And infinitely more importantly, we can find within ourselves those great and beautiful things. Amen. And now for the care and sustenance of this community of faith, we now will accept today's offering.